Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Well, hi again, everyone. I'm Mark Arnay, and this is On The Mark. It is not quite the same On The Mark as you've become used to over the years. A little bit different. We may occasionally take a deep dive into the stories behind the stories, and occasionally just a couple of toes into the water. And frankly, as cold as it's been lately, I think toes are all I want wet these days. Our guest today is Rich Lisk, who is heavily involved with the New York Riptide of the National Lacrosse League. And not only does he have some stories to tell about lacrosse and arena football and other aspects of his life, but he's got a really important story to tell. And first, I want to say, Rich, thank you for joining me. How are you and how is your family holding up in this very bizarre time with the quarantine still a big part of our lives?
No, I appreciate you having me. Thanks for having me. And you know what? It's been good so far. I have three kids. My wife and I, we're in Lawrenceville, New Jersey right now. The good thing is I had two kids that were in school in Boston. So we got them home and my daughter got out of New York City just in time. So it's been fun. It's been really good. I get the chance to reconnect a little bit when your kids are off at college and working and in all these different places. You don't get a chance to have those dinners every night. So that's been good to be able to bring back the dinners every night. We have a very fierce competitive ping pong tournament every night in the garage, which has been great. And we busted out the Wii sports console and we've been Wii golfing and Wii bowling and Wii boxing every night too. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, my wife and I keep talking about getting the Wii out of mothballs, but we're down a controller. So if you have an extra one, maybe we can arrange for you to send one my way.
We'll look into it. Yeah, that'd be great.
Of course, sanitized, please.
Of course.
These days, or at least the last time we checked before the unfortunate cancellation of the Riptides and National Lacrosse League season, you were the executive vice president and in charge basically of all the lacrosse and business operations for the team.
Yeah, no, it's been, I just took on that title. When I came over here, I've been in the league 8 years. I was with 2 years with the Philadelphia Wings, and then we got sold to the Mohegan Sun Casino. And we started the New England Black Wolves there. I was the GM of the New England Black Wolves for the for six of those years. And, you know, I was proud of that team. And we did a lot of good things there and put really indoor lacrosse on the map up in Uncasville, Connecticut. And then I got called from GF Sports to come over here and help with their sports division. We have other entities, too. We have two tennis tournaments. We have a Wolfpack Ninja Warriors. We have an event with the AKC, the American Kennel Club, and the Riptide is our big crown jewel of that dossier. And so I came here in January to work on the team. And in the first couple of months, it was really getting used to the business operations and setting up the office and things. And then in this last month, I took over doing the lacrosse operations side. So I'm diving in on that side also now. And then we had the cancellation of the season. We're still a little bit in hiatus with playoffs, even though the playoffs doesn't affect our team. We weren't very good on the floor this inaugural season. We were 1-12. So there will be no playoffs for us, but the league is deciding if they want to move forward on a playoff scenario. But it's really hard trying to figure that out because 85, 90% of our guys are Canadian and live in Canada. So the borders are closed. And we're trying to figure out how that could possibly work. So for us, the Riptide, it's really our off season started a little bit earlier, and it's actually been a very good time for us to put some things in place for next year, and things that I think we could do better, and things that we did better, expand on those and make them even better than what they were. But we're doing a lot of those things, which has been really refreshing. And for me, jumping in here in January, it gives me a chance to kind of reset things and put a stamp on it.
Well, I had a chance, Rich, to catch a couple of Riptide games on MSG Network. Your play-by-play guy, Dave Leno, is a buddy of mine. We go back a ways. And your public address announcer at Nassau Coliseum is one Colin Cosell, who does the PA for the Mets at Citi Field, among other things, and is, we should mention, the grandson or one of the grandsons of the late legendary Howard Cosell. I don't want to get either of them in trouble, but I have to ask, just out of curiosity, what's it like working with those guys?
I loved it. I love it. I've worked with Dave too in the past when I ran the when I had my own sports marketing company. I did some work for when they brought back a minor league hockey team to New Jersey in Trenton, and Dave was our PA announcer at the time. And I had a really good chance to work with him there very closely. And then again, while running my own sports marketing firm, I worked with the World Team Tennis, where Dave is the voice of the Philadelphia Freedom. So I had a good chance to work with them there. I worked with Colin's cousin, Greg Cosell, when I was at the Arena Football League. He shared an office with Ron Jaworski. So when I used to go there and I'd sit and talk with those guys, Greg was there. So Colin and I chatted about that. And then the other day, we do on Fridays, we do a virtual happy hour. Colin was on our virtual happy hour, and he was walking us around his apartment and showing us all the memorabilia with his grandfather and things. And I could tell you, there's no two better people. That was done before I even got here, so I take no credit for it. But when we hired Dave Leno, Danny Wexelman, and Mitch Belisle to be our broadcast team on MSG, and then they had Colin to do our PA announcers. Again, I don't take credit for that at all, because that was done before me, but they couldn't have picked better people to do it. They're professional. They're so knowledgeable, and they're studious and hard workers. Like, sometimes you get people that kind of show up and do their thing, but these guys know just as much about the team as I do, which is refreshing. And they have a passion for it too, which has been great. Colin's adding a flair because he has such a personality, and he's very, very funny. He's a stand-up comic too, I believe. And he's been really taking over, and we're talking about next year where we'll say our games are being hosted by him, where he will get him out from behind the table a little bit and get him out in the public.
Yeah, I was on a Zoom interview that he did actually with Dave and another PA announcer last week. Kevin Casey from Philadelphia handles the Union soccer matches. And it came up, you know, the obvious question, as we're starting to very slowly get back to the quote-unquote normal in sports, very slowly, I should add, what are the considerations being given to a league like the National Lacrosse League if we have to go and have buildings without fans in them when the new seasons start?
Yeah, you know, that's something we're talking about. I sit on the COVID-19 committee for the league, and we're talking about everything. We're discussing every possible scenario there. Now, the good thing with the National Lacrosse League is that we don't play till December-ish timeframe, really December. So we've got a good 8 months in front of us, and we can watch these other leagues launch. We can watch and see how they do things well, and then we can expand on it, or things that didn't go so well, and we don't have to do those things. So I think that is a real benefit to us to be able to do that. We have a great broadcast OTT platform with Bleacher Report Live. We do real well with those guys, and we have a deal here in New York with MSG to do at least 9 of our games, possibly could be more. So if we have to go with no fans, that's what we'll do. The other part is, though, is I think by then you're going to be loosening up, and it'll not be maybe not so much no fans, but different capacities. And that's something that we're working on now as a staff, figuring out what those scenarios could look like. So if it's a 50% capacity, what does that look like? 75%, 25%, and then how we do that. So I'd rather have the good thing is, again, is our ramp up time. It's not like I have 2 months to do that or 3 months to do that. I have 8 months to sit and do it. So we're doing it now, and it gives us an opportunity to look at everything. So when we get to December and it comes down to it, we could say, okay, we've already worked on these scenarios. This one will work. Let's put this one in place.
Rich, as much as Long Island is a hotbed for lacrosse, you know, kids grow up playing the schools collegiately that feature lacrosse. Hofstra's had a nationally renowned program for years and years. And of course, you know, the high school system produces legendary players and has for a long time now. But still, lacrosse professionally is very much a niche sport. So I'm wondering, especially from a business standpoint, how important was it that the Riptide were able to make this deal in its first season with MSG Network to be televised?
Huge. It's a huge, huge deal. And you're right. I mean, we are probably in the, and there's certain pockets of the country that are what I call very lacrosse rich. And this is one of those pockets. There's so many people coming out and starting off playing lacrosse. But there's also that segment that we are entertainment. We're affordable family entertainment. So how do we get that across? How do we really get into that lacrosse market and that affordable family entertainment market and build our brand, right? We're in the New York market. That's a very crowded entertainment market. And again, I don't take credit for this at all. It was done by our owners beforehand. By the first thing they did was go out and get MSG. And I think that adds legitimacy to a lot of things. I think that gets our product out there in front of people. It gets our product out there in front of people that maybe aren't lacrosse players, and they're different athletes and different people that like different sports. So it really, really exposes us to a nice pocket of people. And I couldn't be happier now stepping into that and working with guys like Armando over at MSG that love our sport and really are getting behind it. I mean, they took the time to make a Riptide in 30 when we won our game and replayed that numerous amounts of time. We get so much cross promotion back and forth on that network that, you know, we didn't have that really when I was in Connecticut. We were in Uncasville, Connecticut, 45 minutes from Hartford, 45 minutes from Providence. It was a different market. So to be able to walk into this marketplace and be able to have a partner like MSG and what they do and have them believe in what we do, it's been tremendous, a tremendous partnership and a great thing for this organization.
Now, the season was interrupted when the sports world went on pause, and effectively it's over. So theoretically, you're in the off season now, and usually in the off season, most teams, especially in this area, will do a lot of fan engagement to get their brand out there and to build brand awareness. But given the current climate with, again, you know, for the most part, we're under a quarantine, how difficult has it been for the Riptide to sort of get out in the community and do any brand building?
You know what? That's a great question. And I would agree that in normal circumstances, it's different, right? We go to lacrosse games and we go to county fairs and we go to street fairs and we put up our fastest shot and we introduce our product and our brand and logo. So that would have made it a lot easier without going through this pandemic that we're going through. But we switched gears pretty quickly and we were able to tie in. And I don't like using the word sponsors because I don't believe I don't believe in sponsors. I believe in partners. And a lot of the people that worked with us, all the people that worked with us are our partners. So we went to our partners and said, okay, how can we all help together? We're here. We're a community team. We're not going anywhere. So we tied in with, you know, Jersey Mike Subs. And when we tied in with those guys, we're now delivering subs and lunch boxes to assisted living senior care facilities. And we've noticed that that's been tremendous for us. We'll hit about 1600 people within they were in the second week of our 4 weeks of doing it with them. And then another big partner of ours has been MassPath Federal. They did a $5 for every save our goalie made this year. And we were able to raise $5,000 that we donated to Catholic Charities for PPE equipment for the frontline workers, which has been great. Just this morning, I okayed face masks, Yowzies, they're called, Yowzies, Yuzies, I think they're called Yowzies. And they're going to be face masks branded with Orlin and Cohen, one of our biggest partners, and our mascot on some of them and our logo on some of them. And we're going to start distributing those. So those are some of the things that we've been able to get out there. We tied in with Nature's Bounty, which is another one of our partners. And we do Fitness Fridays, where our guys are teaching fitness classes on Fridays. Orlin and Cohen, again, to go back to them, we do a medical minute with Orlin and Cohen. And it talks about, the first couple of ones talked about what the COVID was and how to, what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And now we're going into injury prevention and things, because a lot of people are now starting to exercise, or they were exercising and have taken time off, and then they're going to get back into it. So injuries could happen. So now we're talking about that. So we just switched gears a little bit and used the social media and our outreach to really help us, and then tie in our partners with that also.
I just want to clarify, you mentioned the partnership with Jersey Mike's on Long Island and delivering these lunches. Is it the players who were involved? Are they making these drop-offs?
They are not. It is Jersey Mike's that are doing it, and we're going out with our mascot, and some of our staff has been doing it, because our players, all 90% of them live in Canada.
Right.
And so this is their adopted home during the season. We don't really have any players that are living here right now.
So they were able, the ones who are not from the U.S. were able to get back home.
We got before them. Shutdown. Yeah, we got them out. We got them out before everything shut down.
Logistically, how difficult was that?
Yeah, that was a lot. I mean, we had three players that were living here from Canada that we had to make arrangements to get them back. And the good thing was, is that when it shut down, when the league stopped, we were in a bye week. So our bye week was, is our players don't live here in the marketplace. We have three or four that do. The rest live at home. So they weren't traveling, or they weren't anywhere that we had to get them. They were already home. So that was good. But getting the three or four that were here home was a little bit of because they only had days to do it. And you either got to fly them or get them in a car. And they had all the stuff they lived with. So we made a lot of arrangements to get them back.
And I'm curious to know, of the staff members and the mascot, those who are going out and making these drop-offs, I'm sure, and you'll please correct me if I'm wrong, I'm sure they're taking every precaution, masks, gloves, etc.
Every precaution, mask, gloves, social distancing. We're actually trying, we actually had an idea that our mascot, he's from Long Island. His name is Eddie. He likes to fish. He was going to start delivering things on fishing poles and dropping them on people's desks. We're taking every single precaution we can, and working with Jersey Mike's on that.
Yeah, I assume that. But along those lines, what kind of feedback are you getting from them as to how concerned or anxious they might be about interacting with folks who are not related to them and don't live under the same roof?
You know, I think it's been good. It's been welcome. We're meeting people at the doors. We're not physically going in and dropping stuff off. We're meeting their workers at the doors. We think it's a segment of an audience that's, they're a high risk group, but with that comes sometimes a little bit more social isolation. And we think that this program that we've come up with Jersey Mike's is really taking care of them and helping them. They've seemed to love seeing our mascot through the windows and the doors and laughing and joking with them. The workers that they're frontline workers in the places we go have been tremendous to deal with. We've gotten a lot of feedback after the fact we've left, nice letters, shout outs on social media saying, hey, thank you for thinking of us too during this time. So I think it's been very well received.
Talking again with Rich Lisk, the Executive Vice President for the New York Riptide of the National Lacrosse League. He has not only had extensive experience in lacrosse, but he's worked in the Arena Football League once upon a time with the Philadelphia Soul, working for Jon Bon Jovi, and you were part of their championship team.
Yeah, in 2008. I was there from 2005 to 2008. In 2008, we had a special season, and some people will say Peter Schwartz, actually, he works a little bit with us writing some articles. He was an announcer for the Dragons. And some people will say there was a team in Long Island called the New York Dragons. And there was a very controversial play that went our way. And then we went on to the Arena Bowl and we were in New Orleans and there was 15,000 people and we won the Arena Bowl in a very exciting game on ABC TV. And it was great. So Peter busts me all the time that the game, the controversial call would have went their way. It would have went the other way for the New York team. And I always say, well, Peter, I have a ring that proves it went the right way. So I'll live on that. It was a fun year.
Pete and I go way back. And that story reminds me, of course, of the Yankees-Orioles game one in the ALCS in 96, where I am convinced, and I've actually written up a bit of a treatment for a script, that if Tony Tarasco catches that ball, then it's the Orioles who wind up going on and becoming a dynasty and winning four championships in 5 years. And you know, nobody knows who Derek Jeter is. There would be no Hall of Fame election that comes within one vote of unanimous, at all because Jeffrey Mayer changed the history of the world. Talk about a butterfly effect. But to get back on topic, I'm sure people are curious to know, what's it like to work with John Bon Jovi?
You know, he was great. I will say he was an awesome human being. First and foremost, I think he's an awesome human being. And he's a person that puts his money where his mouth is and really lives. He walks the walk and talks the talk. And he lives the life that he talks about, which is great. And I have a lot of respect for him with that. The other thing I have a lot of respect for John with is that he was very, very, and still is very passionate about the sport of football. He wasn't one of these owners that just put their name on something and they prayed them out every once in a while and to take a picture and stuff. He was a hands-on day-to-day owner. I talked to him every day, picked the colors of the logo, picked the name of the logo, picked how our uniforms looked, was involved with us on free agent signings, would call me up on a Saturday and say, hey, I'm driving through. I'm going to go to practice. Pick me up, go to practice with them, talk to the players, get to know them from the business standpoint, everything. One of the most hands-on owners I've ever dealt with, one of the most passionate people I've ever dealt with, and one of the most impressive people I've ever had the chance to be around.
So I guess the question begs, how did you wind up in New York?
In with the Riptide?
Yeah.
All right. So I'm in Philadelphia for 2 years with the Philadelphia Wings. And then we get sold to Uncasville, Connecticut, the Mohegan Sun Casino. And we started that team called the New England Black Wolves. I was the assistant GM at the time because there was a GM who oversaw both sports teams, the Connecticut Sun and the new Black Wolves team. We had 10 weeks to put that team together. And when I say put the team together, that was buying glass, buying boards, buying turf, buying uniforms, everything, logos, everything. We put that team together, and it's actually a funny story I tell when I meet some of our season ticket holders. I say, we went 2-0. We won our first game 17-7. We went 2-0. Everyone thought that we were geniuses. And then we went 2-14 down the stretch, and it was a long season. We overhauled the team on the lacrosse end, and I got elevated up to be the GM at that point. And we elevated and we overhauled the team, and we went 10-8 the next year. We won some good accolades, Coach of the Year, GM of the Year. We fell a game short of getting to the finals, and then we built that organization. And I coming from a business background too, I consulted and helped in the front office, even though we had a person, her name is Amber Cox, and she runs our business side of things for the Black Wolves. But Amber and I had a great, great relationship, and we worked hand in hand on things. So I would help do some of the business side, and I would do all the lacrosse side. And then through mutual friends, I got called by GF Sports to talk to them about stepping in and working on all of their sports properties. And then, you know, one thing led to another, and they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I came over here to work with these guys and help expand our whole sports division, with the Riptide being one of the teams under that.
And you have also done some work with a couple of pretty big name tennis tournaments, the Atlanta Open for one, and of course the New York Open, which has now taken place, if memory serves, the last 2 years at Nassau Coliseum.
Yes. Yeah, last couple of years at Nassau Coliseum in the month of February, which is great. That was my first one this year, so I got to observe it and understand it. We're actually putting together a marketing plan now for next year and a business tactical plan for next year on that. getting our staff hired and things. And then the Atlanta Open, we've been working on that. I have not seen that one physically with my own two eyes yet, but we've been working on it from a distance, and we're just waiting for everything to kind of lift here or let us know whether that event's going to take place or not. But we're preparing for that. It will take place in the month, end of month of July into August. And then we'll get that one off the ground also. So I'm looking forward to it.
And Rich, we've heard a lot about the major tennis tournaments. Obviously Wimbledon canceled for the first time since World War II. The French Open has been backed up, and there was talk from the French Tennis Federation president over the weekend that they may hold the tournament without fans. We know what's been going on in Flushing Meadows, where they're using the indoor facility for a hospital. And Louis Armstrong Stadium, with the roof closed, has been converted into a commissary to help feed all the workers on the front line. In your mind, how practical would it be? What are the chances that we might see a U.S. Open without any fans come late August, early September?
You know, that's going to be a good question. I know what we're dealing with a little bit is we'll know here in the next couple of weeks how the ATP is going to deal with their stuff. We know that they have shut everything down until at least July. We'll see how that goes. This part of the country, it's a little difficult, right? The New York area has been hit really, really hard. I think if there is an event that could get off the ground, it's tennis itself. I have a good buddy that works in NASCAR. We sat around the other day talking about what sports did we think could come back, NASCAR, tennis, golf, you know, where you have limited interaction with teams and you're not really in a team, you're an individual sport. So you could keep that social distancing between the competitors and things. So I think if any sport has its spot to do, it's those three. With tennis, that's a big tennis tournament. It's good for the psyche of the world. It's good for the psyche of America. It's good for television. It's a television sport. It's driven by television also. So I think if there is an opportunity, there's something they'll look at. They'll exasperate every single effort to see if that event could get off the ground. And I hope it does, because it's a great sport for not just the, you know, New York area, but for the United States and the world. That's a big one that people like to see. And there's been a lot of great history made at that tournament. So I'd like to see it get off the ground. But I think, you know, we'll know here now with the social distancing still in effect, but lapsing some of the how we get back to being quote unquote normal, that'll tell a sign here in the next couple of weeks how we move forward and how fast we move forward.
And given what you said about the lacrosse situation not playing until December, you have to figure that because the New York Open won't take place until next February, that you'll have that much more time to put a plan in place. But the expectation, or at least the hope, is that you'll be able to have, if not a full crowd at the Coliseum, some sort of socially distanced, reduced fan participation.
Yeah, and I think being in February, that gives us a good ramp up time. And it gives us a chance to kind of look and see how other sports are going to deal with it. But it gives us a good chance to put a plan in place to really go full force. And then if we have to adjust that plan, I always like to say it's easier to adjust down than it is to kind of adjust up. So let's start at the top. And if we have to adjust down and scale it back, we'll scale it back. And that's something that I'm excited for, because, again, I wasn't here. I got here in January and that event went off in February. So I was able to physically see it, but I wasn't really involved in it. And I'm really looking forward to being involved with it this year and see how we grow that event.
Well, I was promised by the folks who helped arrange this conversation that you had an interesting story, and that has certainly lived up to the billing. Your career is, to quote the Beatles, a long and winding road. Where do you go from here?
You know what? I'm extremely ecstatic of what GF Sports is doing. I would love to, I always joke around and say I have three kids and I've won two rings, so I need another one to make sure when I'm not here anymore that they don't fight over the two. But so I'd like to win another ring, which would be nice. I'm extremely excited about what GF Sports has planned for the future, whether, you know, we got hit with this pandemic or not, the future is still bright. I like being on the cutting edge of some of the things we can do. And the way I look at it is we're going to be able to shape and formulate what the new norm is leading forward with sporting events and live events. And that's exciting to me, to be able to put a stamp on something and do that. And I'm really looking forward to that challenge. Our industry is a, you know, it's an industry that, yes, this will affect it, but we have a chance to really formulate what that new industry and that new norm will look like. And to me, that's really, really, really exciting. So that's where, that's what I'm looking forward to.
So we have talked about your interesting career, but I mentioned at the outset that you had a very important story to tell, which has frankly nothing to do with your career, at least as far as I can tell, just from skimming my notes, but I'll let you fill our audience in. Your childhood was not an easy one, and it's only recently that you have begun to talk about the circumstances and the things that you had to go through. And I'm wondering if you could, if you don't terribly mind, fill our audience in on whatever degree you want to get into it.
Yeah, no. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity and the forum to talk about it. And like we talked about before this interview started, I grew up in a town called Union Beach, which is a small town on the Jersey Shore. And I joke around with my wife and stuff, and I always say it's the gateway to the shore. This is the gates that open up the Jersey Shore. And you know, we came from a different background. My mother was married at a very early age. She had me at a young age. I've never met my original father. He became a drug addict and an alcoholic and left when I was 4 or 5 years old. And I've never met him. I've never had any contact with him since. My mother remarried a gentleman, and he abused me from the age of 10 to the age of 18. At age 18, I left home and never went back. And I've been on my own, quote unquote, on my own since. Put myself through school with the help of some friends and family and things, and then got out. But the reason I got into sports was it was my solace. It was my safe place. I was always pretty good in sports. I was a good baseball player. I played all the other sports, but baseball was the sport that I really gravitated to. And I thought I was going to be the shortstop of the New York Yankees. And then as I got older, the world showed me that, you got to be able to hit the ball a little bit better. And I was a good fielder, but when I was on that field as a child, it was the only place that I wasn't hit. It was the only place that no one could get at me. Those foul lines, when I stepped between those foul lines and onto that field that was surrounded by a fence, no one could touch me and no one could hurt me. And it developed my sense of camaraderie. This was a team that I had. It developed my sense of what I thought a family should be. You stick up for your teammates, you go to battle with your teammates, you fight for your teammates. And again, it was a safe place. That was my reasoning. And my stepfather, he and I did not see eye to eye. We were different people. He didn't like sports. He didn't understand it. I don't think he was very good at it. He was a you know, he grew up in a different way. He was very a manual laborist. Not that there's anything wrong with that at all, but the way he grew up is what he did. He didn't go to high school. He dropped out of high school. So he and I would argue all the time about sports. And I said, I'm going to make my living in sports. And he'd say that I would amount to nothing in the world of sports. And why am I wasting my time? And don't go to school and get a trade done and learn how to work on a car. And, you know, to this day, I don't know if that's the reason why I know nothing about a car whatsoever, except that you put the key in, turn it on, and it drives. And maybe it's my subconscious mind telling me not to worry about that. But I wanted to prove him wrong. And I was going to be in the world of sports. Then I figured out that I couldn't play at the level that I needed to do to make a living. And I went into the business side of things. And I think that's a driving force behind why I do what I do. But it's also one of the things that it gives me not a huge platform, but a little bit of a platform to be able to get out and talk to kids. For many years, I didn't talk about what happened to me. And from the outside in, you wouldn't have known it. From the outside in, we were, you know, Union Beach isn't Rumson and Homedale and things like that. It's not high on the socioeconomic scale, but we weren't the lowest either. And when you looked at my family, it was a blended family. I had a brother who was my biological brother and two stepsisters. So you would have looked at a blended family and you wouldn't have known anything. But when those doors closed, it was a whole different world. And people say you don't know what happens behind closed doors, and you truly, truly, truly don't know what happened behind closed doors. My parents wanted to keep up that facade. They put us in St. John Vianney. There was many a times at St. John Vianney that, you know, I didn't take gym class because I had bruises on my body that I didn't want people to see. There was a time in high school where I was going through a really, really tough time with my father and my mother at the time. And one of my baseball coaches and I got into an argument, and it was just that outlet of me arguing with another person that I know couldn't hit me, right, that I probably went too far and overstepped the bounds that a player should go to a coach, and they threw me off the team. And I had to live with that. I didn't play baseball my junior year, which was a tough one because I probably went too far with somebody in my anger. And it was a lesson that I had to learn. But again, you would not have known that because we looked like a normal family. And that's what I try to do is when I go and do talk to high schools, and I started here in the last couple of years talking to high schools about this, is that I am you. I know exactly what you could possibly be going through. And I want to show you that there is another path. Could I have easily went down the path of drugs and alcohol? Absolutely. Could I have easily went down the path of doing bad, quote unquote, bad things? Absolutely, to get attention. But I didn't. And I found the passion that I wanted to do. And that's what I tell kids, like, hey, you know, step up and say something if something's happening. I was taught, and it was probably the worst thing in the world to teach a kid. You know, when I used to get hit, my mother would come to me, and she's my maternal mother, and she would say to me, you can't say anything. You got to keep it quiet. It'll go away. Don't worry about it. It won't happen again. And I would believe her, and then it would happen again. No, you can't say anything. They'll take your father away, and as the police will come and take him away, and you can't do that. As a little kid at age 10 years old, you know, I was thrown out of my house 5 times, and I had to pack my stuff into a garbage bag and wait for someone to pick me up on a street corner to take me to somebody's house to live until they would let me back in the house. And then he would let me back in. So those are things that, you know, that was a tough way to grow up, and you didn't feel respected. And I got that respect when I was on the field, and I got that respect from a team. And that's the message I want to get out to people, is that there are people out there like you. You know, it might look all rosy on the outside, but on the inside, there could be some stuff going on. So ask questions, take the time to talk to these kids. That was the one thing I would say, that if I had to go back and do it again or be able to express myself better, because it took me a lot of years to be able to express myself, I would have talked to somebody. But then again, I wish that the teachers at school would have asked more questions, because I wasn't a bad kid. I wasn't that kid that got in trouble all the time. And when this happened to me, or when things like that happened, I wish someone would have stepped back and said, hey, that's not you. You're a straight A student. You're a good player. You're a good ball player. You're a good person. What's going on in your life? And no one asked those questions. So I didn't tell anybody, and I had to live with it. So those are the messages that I like to get out. Sports is my passion. Farm by none, it's family, and then sports are my passion. And I tried to blend the two of them together. And I think I've done a pretty good job at doing that. And that's what I try to get across to kids. Like, be able to, you know, you'll be able to shape your world the way you want, but don't let these little things keep you down. And it could have kept me down, and it didn't. And that's what I'd like to get out and tell people.
Couple of follow-ups, if you don't mind. I really do appreciate you sharing this, and I have a feeling that there are those in our audience who will hear some things that hit nerves, that they've gone through similar situations. I want to start with asking, what was the impetus, the inspiration for you to start talking about this publicly and want to share what you went through?
No, that's a great question. For years and years and years, I never talked about it. You wouldn't have known. And it took me a while to understand that it wasn't my fault. And that was the other thing. Like, you grow up and you hear all these things. Like, I used to hear, well, if your parents were drug addicts and alcoholics, then you're going to be susceptible to being a drug addict and an alcoholic. If you grew up in an abusive household, you're going to be an abuser. So I always lived with that. And that's one of the reasons I didn't want anyone to know, because I didn't want people to think differently of me. I didn't want them to think, oh, his dad left and was a drug addict. Oh, he must be a drug addict. Or he got hit by his dad. He's going to hit somebody. And I didn't want that. So that's one of the reasons I kept it bottled up really for a long, long time. But then I realized as I got older, it's not healthy. I was you know, sometimes mental manifests itself into physical. Right. And, you know, I just didn't feel right. I didn't feel like I was giving my best effort to my family, my kids. I mean, I didn't want that for my kids either. And I needed to open up and I needed to get that off my chest because, you know, I was doing what I thought was right. I was doing well, quote unquote, well, but I could have been doing so much better. And the minute I started to open up about it and I realized that people weren't judging me and I realized that people weren't going to look down on me, it became easier and easier to talk to. And believe me, I didn't do it all on my own. You know, I had help. I finally went to somebody and said, listen, I got to get this out because there are times I'm not fun to be around, or there are times that I know I'm closed off, and there are times that I know I'm not moving to the best I can. So I need to talk to someone. And I found somebody that would sit and talk to me about it. And she was great. She was a therapist that I went to, and I sat with her for a while, and we went through a lot of things, and she peeled back a lot of those layers. And that was another stigma, right? You're in sports, you're masculine, you're this, you're that. People don't ever want to say that I need help. And it was another hurdle that I got over to be able to ask for that. I used to say to myself, well, I've gotten this far now, I don't need anybody. No, I got this far, but I want to be further, and I can't get further until I go through and get some help. So I found this this person that worked with me, and she was great. And then that opened it up. And then when I started realizing that people weren't going to judge me, or people weren't going to look at me differently, and they were going to judge me on who I was and who I am, it was easier for me to accept it. And then I went to a high school with the Philadelphia Soul. And this is the first time I ever opened up. One of the players got up and started talking about his personal life. And one of the people asked me a question about my personal, and I can tell you, I never set out to do it. I didn't have a preconceived notion that I was going to walk through the door and talk about it. And I just opened up and said it. And it just flowed out of me to this school. And the principal came up to me and thanked me. And then this kid came up and started talking to me, and he was a really good kid. And you could tell he was a little sheepish and things. And he was asking me some questions, and then he walked away, and the principal came back and he said, you know, we suspect that kid might be in an abusive household. Mm-hmm. And 2 weeks later, that guy called me, the principal, and said, I want to thank you. He came forward. We were able to get him out. We're getting him help. He's talking to school teachers and counselors and things like that. And we've now gotten involved in it. And that was the first one that really opened it up for me. And again, I can't even tell you, I went in there thinking I'm going to do this. I didn't even think it just came out, and it was probably the right time for it to happen.
Rich, when you look back on that day, how much did it change your life going forward?
Oh God, it was, it was a special day. It was a very, very special day because I don't know if I'd be here if I didn't do that. And I hope that person that listened and the kid, and I haven't had contact with him since. I hope that it has changed his life, and I hope it brought something to him. Because again, I was in a school that you wouldn't, and I don't mean this in a bad way, like it was in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. It was a pretty upscale high school. It wasn't a place that on the outside you'd look in and say, this, and this is happening. And for that to happen, it kind of showed me that it's everywhere. And it's just not in certain segments of the world. It's everywhere. And so it was a pretty powerful moment. I remember coming home and telling my wife about it. And you know what? I'm an emotional person. So I will say there's been some tears shed and things. And that was one of those moments.
Yeah, I would imagine. So we are talking the morning after Mother's Day. And I'm curious, given the relationship you had with your mom, to know what does that particular day mean to you, if anything?
You know, that's a great, great question, because I struggle with Mother's Day a lot. I have not spoken to my mom for 20-something years. It's just not a relationship that I think works for both sides of us, probably a little bit more for me than her at times. But it's just, it's a conscious decision that I made, that it's just better off this way. So I used to struggle with it a lot. But I will say this, my wife, I've been with her again since I was 17 years old. I've watched her mother, model what I believe a mother should be. There was a lady who I call her Mima, I love her to death. She is like a mother to me, if not the only mother that I kind of knew. And she raised seven kids. And I can tell you that's a very, very tight-knit family. And it's all because of her. Her and her husband, Pop, my wife's parents. But Mima has been a rock and has modeled to me what a mother should look like. And then I get the privilege to watch my wife raise our kids, and shows me again how I had this model of what I thought a mother should look like with my mother-in-law. And I see that taken to a whole nother level with my wife and how she is with our kids. So now I embrace this day. I embrace it because I have been lucky enough to have two women in my life like that shows how it should be and the way it should be and the special person that a mother is. For years, I didn't have that, and I used to hate this day. It was hard, but now I embrace this day and love this day for what I've seen it can be and what it should be.
I hope you don't mind me asking, but curiosity is getting the better mm-hmm. of me. You said you mm-hmm. had a brother, full-blooded, yeah. and two stepsisters. Mm-hmm. Are you still in touch with any of them?
I'm in touch with my stepsisters more than the other. My one stepsister, she lives in Hazlitt, New Jersey, and she and I talk frequently. They were caught in it. They were caught in it too. It was weird, even though we were all blended together, and you could on the outside see this family that was, father, mother, two sons, and two sisters. My sisters were with my stepfather, and we were with my mother. So when things started to break apart after I left at around 17, 18 years old, they started breaking apart between the parents. Both parents tried to separate those kids and say, well, you're mine, you can't talk to them, and you're mine, you can't talk to them. So for about 10 years, I did not talk to my sisters. And then my sister Michelle and I reconnected and with her family, and she's got a beautiful, beautiful family, and I have beautiful nieces and nephews that are flourishing in this world and doing a tremendous job. So I look at my sister Michelle as someone who lived through it and came out on the other side and has done really, really well. I do talk to my sister Debbie and her family. She has two wonderful kids too that have done well. My brother decided to take another road and go down a different path, and he decided that he was going to, side kind of with my mom. So I have not talked to my brother for over 20 years too. But that's okay. I mean, that's the path that they decided to take, I always say your intentions are good. I shouldn't expect anything back. I put out the good intentions and it'll come back to me that way. And eventually, who knows, maybe those bridges will be healed. But right now, I think this is the best path for all of us, especially with me and my brother.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to ask, you're not exactly a top billing guy. I mean, you've got a pretty lofty position and have had several over the years, but you don't live anonymously. And I'm wondering, have your mom and or brother reached out to you that you know of?
No, they have not. I think, again, that's their decision. It's kind of my decision too. When you have children, things change. Thinking changes. You're not just thinking about yourself anymore. I'm responsible for four other lives with my wife, but she's really responsible for all of us. but with my kids, I'm responsible for them too. So I have to bring them up the best way I think is best for them. And at that point and the relationship that I was with my mother and brother, it was better off this way. It just, I did not see them. And maybe this is a little bit egotistical from my part. And I apologize if it comes across like this, but I didn't see them making the necessary changes or taking the necessary responsibilities for what happened to get past it. It was always going to be there, and it was always going to be this underlying thing that I didn't want to expose my children to.
And I think, again, a lot of people who are hearing this will probably be able to recognize a situation, if not identical, then certainly very similar. And I don't mean to come across flip in any way.
Not at all.
You've had me thinking for a while now. Grew up down the shore. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, given the situation that you were leaving when you graduated high school to go off to college, you mentioned to me before we started recording that you went to Rutgers. Was mm-hmm. Rutgers far enough away to get out of that situation?
You know what? It was weird. I went to Monmouth my first year, and Monmouth was a different world for me. I just didn't know if I fit in there after a year. And again, as a child coming from that background, I was probably searching for something. And right. I probably, if I look back on it now, I made the first decision. I got in there first. I accepted it. I'm out. That's it. I'm going. And then I got there and I'm like, oh, this really isn't for me. And then I'm on my own. So even to go away, like economics played into that. Rutgers was, you know, it was far enough away that I could get housing and live there. So I had a place to live. But it was also cheap enough for me to be able to pay for. Right. And, you know, if I would have went out of state and things, I joke around with my kids, I did get into UCLA. These are the schools I applied to: Monmouth, UCLA, and the University of Hawaii. Okay. So you could see in my mind where I was thinking going.
Right.
I still have not heard back from the University of Hawaii, and always tell my kids when I get accepted, I'm going. And we joke about it. But I got into UCLA. But at the time, I wasn't going to be able to afford UCLA. And then one of my friend group in high school got into Monmouth, and he said, let's go to Monmouth together. And it was a good fit for him. It wasn't a good fit for me. But I was out. This was my out. I was out of the house. I had a place to go. I just had to survive until that time came. And then he and I packed up our car and his parents took us. My parents didn't even take me to college my right. first year. I got moved in by my friends. And then when we got there, he flourished. He went one way. I said, you know what? This isn't really for me. Economically, it's not going to work for me. Rutgers makes sense. And I couldn't have been happier. Rutgers was a great place for me. And it was perfectly spotted for me.
As we wrap things up, and I, again, really do appreciate the time, and I appreciate you sharing your story.
Sure.
You said you've been with your wife since high school, mm-hmm. Who is now the mother of your children, and mm-hmm. this relationship continues. When did you, and not that I'm a relationship guru or anything, but again, curious journalist here, when did you know she was the one?
You know, right off the bat, you kind of know it. You know, as much as you could say, you know it at 17. But she morphed into being my best friend. And that's kind of where we started. We went to high school together. I kind of knew her. She kind of knew me. We started dating and stuff. She saw a lot of things that she probably as a girlfriend shouldn't have seen or been involved with. And, it was, and you know what, she stuck in there and she stayed there, and she would be the one that would look at me and say, you know, this isn't normal. Because at times when you're in it, you think this is normal. This is life. This is what happens. And she would look at me and say, you know what, this isn't what it should be. And, you know, so I would say deep down, I probably knew it right from the beginning. But again, at 17, you don't really know anything at 17. And then we went to college together. She was at Rutgers, and that was another piece for me to go to Rutgers. And then it kind of took off from there. But we've been together a long time and been through a lot of things. And like I said before, she's my best friend. So it makes things a lot easier when you marry your best friend. And I've had that opportunity to do that, and I'm a very lucky man.
It's funny. I'm listening to you tell this story, and I'm thinking we'd already mentioned John Bon Jovi, and that's similar to the way he and his wife, you know, high school sweethearts and all these years, and they may even have gone back before high school in Central Jersey too. And I'm amused that we've been able to tie these relationships and the geography.
Maybe there's something
as awkwardly as we are.
I'm
tying these things
together. There's something in the water down there.
Well, it wasn't there in Old Bridge when I was there. I could tell you that. As we wrap things up, I do want to turn serious again, if you don't mind.
Sure.
What's the message that you want to give to people who are listening right now about your story and about what they can take from it to better their own situations?
You know, it's good. It's my story. I own this story. It is my story. So I appreciate when you say that, because a lot of times people try to push it off that it's not their story. But it is. It is my story. It took me a while to understand that it wasn't my fault. And I want people to understand that too. If you're in a situation like this, it's not your fault. You're in this situation. You were put into this situation by other people that are supposed to be protectors and supposed to be nurturing and supposed to be quote unquote your parents, if that's the case. And it, as it was with me. The message I hope to get across is that I think I waited too long to be able to ask for help or to be able to tell someone what I was in. And I probably, and I know for a fact, I went through a lot of years of stuff that I probably wouldn't have had to go through if I would have opened up earlier and talked about it and sought help. So I encourage someone, if you're at home and you're in a bad situation, it's not your fault. You're not supposed to be in this situation. I used to accept that this was my situation. This is what was given to me. I have to live like this. No, you don't have to live like this. And no, it's not your fault. And ask somebody questions. Find out. Tell someone something. Tell your best friends. Tell your girlfriend. Tell a teacher. Tell someone and get yourself out of that situation. I think I waited too long for that. And again, that's my story to tell. If I can help someone not be in that area and not wait that long, that would be my blessing to them. So that I really think is it.
If you could go back to St. John Vianney, and I know it's a long time ago and there's a lot of water under the bridge, and obviously you have come through this as difficult as it was, do you think that there would have been occasion for you, while you were waiting for someone there, to ask you questions instead, that you went to them and said, hey, you need to be paying better attention because I'm going through this situation and you have no idea?
Yeah, I think there could have been situations. I really do. Again, I was big into sports and I should have probably opened up to my coach and said, hey, you know, there's something going on here. But how do you breach that subject, right? It's hard for the person getting abused like I was to take that next step, because in my mind I'm saying, well, this must be right because my mother is allowing this to happen and so she knows what's going on and this will be okay. Or two, my mother used to swear me to secrecy, and that was the one thing as a son to a mother, a daughter to a mother, like your mother tells you what to do, you do it. And that's the way I grew up with certain things. So I was sworn to secrecy. I think if one person would have just saw something different, it would have been easier for me to do it. I think I was looking, and my personality at the time, I was very sheepish. I was mild. I didn't speak up. I was more of an introvert than I am now. I think one toe over the line would have helped. But then again, I look back on it now, the way I am now, I wish I would have put that toe over the line, and I just didn't. But yeah, I think there was some opportunities at school that would have done it. But again, you know, think about it. I was 10 years old. I'm 50 now. So, you know, between, you know, 40 something years ago, the world was different than it is now, right? Now there's the internet. Now there's ways you can express yourself and, you know, Twitter and Instagram and all these things. Like, we didn't have any of that. So that was a little different. So I think there's more opportunities now for kids to express themselves, hopefully. And I hope people take those things seriously when they do, because it is serious. There is a serious problem out there.
I'm wondering, do you think there is any advice or any pearls of wisdom you might be able to impart to coaches, managers, or teachers who are listening right now?
Yeah, you know what? There are times that you and maybe not all teachers and coaches and people do this, but me personally, like I look at myself when you're running a company and working with people. You know, I'm kind of like a coach, kind of like a teacher at times. If you're a colleague with people, get to know people, get to know them. Just don't make it a factory where they come in, you teach them, they go home. They come in, you teach them, they go home. They come in, you work, you go home. When you get to know people and you get to dive under there and peel back some of those layers, that's when these things come out. That's when you start finding out things about people. And I think nowadays too, and I hope it's not the case, there's so many things coming at us, TV, social media, everything out there, that I hope people just don't walk through the process of being a teacher or a coach. I got an hour and a half with these kids on the field. Let me just teach them how to hit and run. No, take a chance to get to know them. Take a chance to get to know what makes them tick. You know, as a GM of a team in New England and here in New England especially, like a team, yes, I can tell you what you look like when you play and how you play and how that's going to fit into my system. But is that really what's going to make us win games? Like, I want to get to know what makes you tick. I want to get to know your family. I want to get to know that, like, you know, I use John LaFontaine as an example. He was a guy that played with us in New England. He became our assistant captain. I got to know John and his family. John also coaches women's basketball, and his whole family coaches women's basketball. Women basketball is a very close-tied sport to indoor lacrosse, so John had this high IQ because of that. If I didn't take the time to understand John or understand his family, I would have never known that. And that's what I try to say, is that you're a teacher, you're a coach, you're a parent, you're a friend. Take time to get to know people, because then you'll know if there's something wrong and you can help get them out of that.
Do you think that having gone through this experience, you are better able to see signs of trouble in other people, in your colleagues, in your employees, in your friends?
I think so, a little bit. I think, and even if I don't have that expertise to do it, I didn't go to school for it and know the touch points and things, I do take time to get to know them. And I do take time to get to understand everybody and their families. And if I see something that is out of quote unquote the norm with them from what I know, yeah, I'll ask more questions. I think I've become more inquisitive about things like that. I think I've become more sensitive to things like that. And I am that person that'll ask questions like, hey, that doesn't seem right. Like, what about this? What about this? And, oh, okay, you said this, but what about this? And maybe that helps. That's an interesting question, because I never looked at it like that, but I can see my personality is a little bit like that, yeah.
Again, I really do appreciate you spending this much time and diving into this story. I would like to leave everyone with a little ray of hope, if we can. And hopefully this is a fun way to wrap things up. When the quarantine is fully lifted and you're able to leave the friendly confines of Lawrenceville and get back to Long Island, even before then, what is at the top of your list of things to do once we're no longer in a quarantine?
Oh, I can't wait to get back to the beach. I like to surf, and I like to be at the beach, and I just like to be in the sand and hear the waves, and that's my place. Like, that is, when all said and done, I will be end up at the beach. So that is probably really, really high on my list. That was one of the things I was like, when we were getting ready to move to Long Island, you know, you're going to take someone from New Jersey that's been here his whole life and go to Long Island. I said, there's a lot of beaches in Long Island. Mm-hmm. So at least if I can get back to the beach and just that, you know, not wearing shoes and wearing a pair of shorts and taking a stroll on the boardwalk, that's what I'm probably missing the most right now. And if we get to Memorial Day and we're still in this social distancing like that, that's when I think it'll really hit me, because that's really when it all starts. So my one thing is, God, I can't wait to get back to the beach.
You and me both. You would, from a Jersey kid to a Jersey kid, please let me go back to the beach.
That's all I need. Give me the beach.
We've been talking with Rich Lisk, Executive Vice President of the New York Riptide of the National Lacrosse League. And before we let you go, let's give the potential lacrosse fans in the audience, Riptide fans, a chance to know the team a little bit. Star player, players. Not that you want to single anybody out.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Like, we had the first pick in the draft, and again, before I got here, so I will not take credit for it, but the team picked Tyson Gibson. Tyson Gibson, it's actually an interesting story, because Tyson's father worked for me in New England as my offensive coordinator. We had the third pick. New England, New York had the first pick. I was hoping that he'd fall to three so I could reunite him and his father, and they took him number one. So I'm happy. From when I was in New England, I wasn't happy, because I would have liked right. to have the father son together. Plus, he's going to be a really, 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 really good player for many years to come. And then I come here and I'm like, well, thank God we didn't draft Tyson Gibson, because now I got him. And so he's a future star in this league, which I think will be a really cool thing to watch. The other thing with this team is that we have a good mix of Americans and Canadians. So some of these American kids have really stepped forward and done well. A kid like Connor Kelly, who's a local kid from Fairfield, Connecticut, and lives in New York when we are there. So he's really cemented himself in the marketplace. So I think the fans will really enjoy him. You know, we had a guy like we're an expansion team. So it gives these guys an opportunity to play. When I first came into the league, we had 9 teams. Now we have 13, which makes the player pool bigger. So a guy like Dan Lomas, who was kind of on the cusp with some of these teams, comes in here and gets a chance to play full time and scores 21, 22 goals with us and led our team in goals. So there's an exciting thing. I'm looking forward to seeing Dan's career take off. And I love the fact how we have these veteran guys that have kind of stepped forward and said, okay, let me take control of the locker room and let me help teach these kids. So guys like Dan McCray and Andrew Suter and John Rannigan, who are our captains, they've really stepped forward and taken these, a lot of young kids, under their belt. And listen, we had our lumps this year. We were 1-12, no bones about it. But there's a good foundation there and there's some really good pieces. I'm happy to say when you go 1-12 and you come in last, there is some riches at the end of the rainbow. So we have the first pick in the draft again this year, it looks like. So that'll be good. So we had another good piece there. And we have a great ownership group, and we've created a great atmosphere and a great locker room. So we'll be very active in the free agent market. So I think with what people saw last year and the foundation we've built and what hopefully we can bring to the table and add to that foundation, it's going to be a very exciting season and a very exciting team, not for this year and next year, for a lot of years to come.
And once the Islanders move to Belmont, you and the G League Nets will be the anchor tenants.
That's it. It's us and the Nets. We will be there. And if you hockey is very, very close to this lacrosse sport. And again, 80, 90% of our guys come from Canada, and a lot of our guys have played both sports. So if you like hockey and you don't know anything about lacrosse, try us on, because it's a very close sport, and I think you'll enjoy it.
We've gone for nearly an hour, and remarkably, I at no point called you Richie Zisk. And I don't know how. I mentioned to you earlier that I was concerned, yeah, because having grown up a baseball fan and seeing the name Lisk, and especially Rich Lisk, I was concerned that I would fall into old habits and call you Richie Zisk.
Well, we figured out he had a pretty decent career. So if that was the if I was going to get to the major leagues and I had to go that route, okay, I would have been okay with that.
Well, you've had a pretty decent career of your own, and many years to come, a continued success and continued good luck. And hopefully we'll be able to see you at the Coliseum for not only some New York Riptide games, but for the New York Open when tennis returns in February.
I'd love that. Please come out and let's grab an adult beverage together and relax and watch a game.
I know a few places, having gone to school at Hofstra.
Oh, then I'll follow you, because I'll be new to that area. So yes, I'd look forward to it.
I'm Mark Renee. That's Rich Lisk, and you're On the Mark.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.